You're free now. Free to stream beyond your wildest dreams. Free to be everything you imagine, and then some. That's how it feels to have Quantum Fiber. Your world unleashed. Learn more at quantumfiber.com. Limited availability. Service in select locations only.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome to KSL at Night. We are happy to be here with you. Lots of news. Mara Caraballo, Leah Murray. Leah, you know, usually, well, this is the weekend after the state convention. I'm going to say usually we do a little bit of let's recap. We are going to give this some time because according to absolutely everyone, all of the political folks out there, this was an unusual and crazy, particularly Republican convention. So let's start with just a big headline. It was 17 hours long. So if you bought a ticket, you got your money's worth.
This oh my gosh. But that explains why.
What is that, Five Eras Tour?
Yeah, that is. It's the Five Eras Tour. But I was literally kind of looking for results. Does that make sense? I'm thinking, how do we not know more? It feels like we should have more.
Right.
And now that makes sense to me. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't really even start the statewide conversations until the rest of us were having supper. So it was quite something. But we had boots on the ground that day at KSL. And so Bridger Beal Svetko, did I say it right, Bridger? That was a long pause there. But Bridger was at the convention. And Bridger, thanks for joining us on KSL at Night to talk through what happened at the Republican Party's convention this weekend.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And you nailed it. So thanks.
So, okay, start with just, we'll just take a minute on the back end, because I really feel like this has been a complaint this election cycle. So the Republicans and actually the Democrats had a great caucus turnout in March, but there were some complaints about the voting. This past Saturday, the convention opened the doors at 7. They were supposed to start local House and Senate seats. They were supposed to do an 8 to 9 and a 9 to 10. My understanding is we didn't even get started an hour and a half late because of some problems voting. So tell us about what voting was like that day and how did we start out with technical difficulties?
Yeah, I mean, it was for anyone that went to some of the caucus events a couple weeks ago that had long lines and issues with registration. I think it was some of the same things that were on display here. I got there about 7:45-ish, and there was lines wrapped throughout the convention center. It took delegates sometimes 2 to 3 hours to get checked in, waiting in line. So I don't know if it was an issue with the systems or not enough staff or whatever there, but just took a long time to get everyone settled. Almost 5,000 delegates, I think 4,500 were there is what they estimate, and just took forever to get things going. And then once the votes happened, each vote seemed to take sometimes 20 to 30 minutes with more technical difficulties with delegates struggling to get their vote in or struggling with the app that they used. So a lot of glitches, it seemed like, throughout the night that really pushed the beginning of the day and then really dragged everything out all Saturday.
So I'm going to tell you what, when my IT doesn't work well in any phase of my existence, I become, the worst version of Leah Murray that shows up into any conversation.
Like you're having a bad TSA experience at the airport.
Oh my goodness, right? Every time. So Bridger, to a certain extent, do you think, right, what you're talking about, these technical difficulties led to what we've all heard is that, man, there were some feisty, rowdy people at that convention? Is like that what was going on?
That could have been part of it. A lot of people were upset that we were using electronic voting at all. There was a lot of anger that it seemed like a small handful of delegates who wanted to move to paper balloting, which I was told would have taken at least another 5 to 6 hours and wasn't really feasible. They didn't have paper ballots ready or anything, but it seemed like there was a lot of anger about just the way that they use the electronic voting from people that were worried about fraud. And then just a lot of other anger at, incumbent Republicans. Governor Spencer Cox got booed. I think everyone expected that to happen, but there was a lot of vitriol at some of those incumbent representatives and elected officials, I think, that probably was exacerbated by the 2 to 3 hours spent in line in the morning, for sure.
So, Bridger, let's talk about people a little bit more. Let's talk about those who got the convention nod and what some of the results are. I want to start with maybe the one I think shows the starkest contrast, which is, let's start with the U.S. Senate race. A bunch of people going in. Several people have already committed to signature gathering. But walk us through who came out of convention for the U.S. Senate race, which is the race to replace Mitt Romney.
Yeah, the big winner probably of the whole convention, or one of the big winners, was Trent Staggs. He's the mayor of Riverton right now, running for U.S. Senate. He got a big boost in the morning. Former President Donald Trump endorsed him before the proceedings began. So that was a big shot in the arm to his campaign, I think, with the delegates. He ended up winning that race, but he'll face three challengers in the primary who have already gathered signatures. Representative John Curtis is running for that seat, as is former Utah House Speaker Brad Wilson and Jason Walton, an entrepreneur and the founder of a pest control company. So we narrowed down that field from the 10 that there were initially, but it's still going to be a pretty wide open, pretty drawn out primary with four contenders going forward.
So, Leah and Bridger, as we talk about this, Leah, let's take this as a moment to maybe juxtapose. There was an opinion research poll that came out that was done. It concluded April 16th. So it was sort of done a week before this. And as Bridger said, Mayor Staggs flew out of convention with a decisive victory, but it's really not in a line with this Republican average voter poll, which told us that John Curtis was coming in at 27% of the vote. He did signature gather. Brent Hatch, 11%. He did not make it out of convention. Brad Wilson, 10%. He signature gathered. And in this poll, Trent Staggs only got 5% of the vote. So he's outperforming. The delegates are 40 plus percentage points more in favor of Staggs than it appears the average Republican voter.
Yeah, and Bridger, before you answer that, let me just add to it and just flip into a different race, because the same is true of data, right, Mara, around Governor Cox. So like you said, Bridger, he gets booed. We get Lyman coming out of convention, but in a poll, Cox is like just leading the field. He's got 51% approval. So can you speak a little bit to that disconnect, what we're seeing in polling of Republican registered voters versus what we saw among delegates at the convention?
Yeah, and that's a great point. That was one of my biggest takeaways from the convention, and is that Governor Cox is wildly popular. I think a recent poll, it might be that same one that you cited in the Senate race, showed him with something like 80% support from Republicans at this point. Republicans broadly, not just the delegates at convention. So, but he got beat. I believe Phil Lyman, a state representative who's running against him, got about 72% of the vote at convention. So he got beat pretty handily at convention, but seems to be leading in the general popular vote. So I think it's been talked about a lot in recent years, the split between the delegates, who tend to be a little more conservative, a little bit further to the right than the general electorate, that it's not uncommon for incumbents to lose at the convention, but qualify for a primary and go on to do pretty well. So while a couple of those people, Blake Moore also is one that lost at convention, but he gathered signatures. He's an incumbent congressman and is probably expected to advance as well. So I think that's a through line that this delegate pool is a small representation that's not necessarily representative of the party as a whole.
Bridger Beals-Fetko, thank you so much for spending your time all day there.
I know,
Saturday.
Were you there 17 hours?
I was, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Probably 18 if you count the time that it took trying to get out of the parking garage after. But it was a long day.
That's great.
Thanks for your coverage of this event. And Leah, we're not done. I mean, we want to go a little bit deeper in this and talk about the consequences, but we also have a really seasoned person coming up. We have a couple of guests who have been in every position you can possibly be in, and we want to get some more insight to what Saturday means for the rest of us as voters and what it was like to be there. So stay tuned with us on KSL at Night.
It's finally time to say goodbye to the snow and hello to spring, and right now is the best time to spring into adventure in an RV from a Motorsportsland RV Center. Through this week, come check out Motorsportsland's season kickoff event and find the RV you've been dreaming of. Save thousands and even tens of thousands off MSRP and find your next adventure at a Motorsportsland RV Center today.
Let Motorsportsland help you get away.
Motorsportsland.com.
911, what's your emergency?
I kidnapped my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Transform your home in one weekend with paint from Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Mara Carabello. And Mara, we are talking all things convention because, first of all, it was graduation weekend for me, but it was convention weekend for most people who are interested in politics. We're going to bring in, I feel like, your favorite person to talk about politics
Absolutely.
On the planet. So we are bringing in Greg Hughes, former Utah Speaker of the House. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Leah and Mara. Thank you. Happy to be on the show.
Now, look, I have got an expectation that you all are going to disagree better as you talk about what is happening in the Republican convention. So, you know.
Yeah, I think we're going to flip roles. I'm gonna start, Greg, with this question. From the Republican point of view, is the caucus convention system officially broken?
I think if you were to take it from the horrific experience on Saturday, you would never, ever want to live through a 17-hour convention again. If that were if that's the rule of what we have to live through going forward, I think if you go back to caucus night, it was a disaster, and this convention was historically at 17 hours the longest and worst run convention I think the state's ever seen. So if that would be if that's the par for the course, I don't know who in their right mind would ever return to another state convention. But I don't think that you have to have 17-hour conventions. So I would hope we can still have our caucus convention cycle, but we can never live through the caucus night or a convention like we just had.
All right. So, Greg, the Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson tweeted that the GOP convention is no longer a family-friendly environment, and then goes on to say that her nieces were subject to vulgarity and viciousness. She's just mortified. I'm wondering, did you feel like that? Like, 17 hours is a lot. Does that make sense? But you could just be like, we were all there for 17 hours and we were all very well behaved and it was just boring. But did you feel like you also saw that kind of viciousness that the lieutenant governor is talking about? Was that like the mood of the convention?
So Yeah. So I saw her post. I did not, and I'm not saying it didn't happen. I did not hear vulgarity. I didn't, and by vulgarity, I didn't hear people dropping F bombs. There wasn't a lot of swearing going on. Was there rudeness? Yes. The one thing that I would say though is that's been a sad maybe element of some of these conventions in times past. I can tell you 10 years ago when I was a candidate, the person running against me, my daughter was 15 at the time. My daughter had tears streaming down her face from the nastiness of the speech against me from my opponent. And so those aren't things that you should accept or say are fine. But just because you experienced some of that harshness on Saturday doesn't mean it never happened before or that it's acceptable going forward. But I don't think it's one of these moments where we can never have a convention again. I think it's and I think that the cure to that is just to have a lot of good participation, which, again, 17-hour conventions will not create stronger participation. But I think if you had everyday people that really try to lean in and be involved, some of those moments, you don't see them as often.
So I feel like coverage has heavily criticized process, whether that was the kind of voting mechanisms we used or just other technical backends. What do you do about this continuing argument about everything? I mean, the Republicans tend to fight over every platform issue. There is no conjunction or adjective too small to not start a cage fight. So do we need more rules of decorum? Like how, in addition to assuming we have a better technological back end, how do we just become more productive about our political conversations at convention?
So Mara, what's disorienting for me is that I have been to conventions, whether they be state or county, where my greatest frustration was the Robert's Rules of Order, where before at the beginning of the agenda, you have to have the delegates approve the rules. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a protracted debate. And
right.
There's points of order, and it's just and then you get to the agenda and people want to change and flip around the agenda. And all these arguments are made to make it faster, but you spend 2 hours arguing to make it faster, and it seems so wrongheaded. This convention did not have that. The rules and the agenda were approved very quickly. Now, we were already 3 hours behind because someone thought putting 4,000 people in a single file line to register was how we would get this done, which was a first. But we didn't have those frustrating moments that you've seen in other conventions in other years where you are fighting over the rules and over the agenda. Think about 1992. I've been going to mm-hmm. conventions since 1992. You had an open governor's race, an open U.S. Senate race, an open second congressional district race. You had an open attorney general's race. You had paper ballots. Imagine that, because technology is supposed to be so much faster. That convention ended, I think, 5 or 6 on that Saturday. If you go to 2004, when it was an open gubernatorial race with a lot of other races and multiple rounds, paper ballots, you didn't see anything close to 17 hours of a convention. And so I don't think this convention really descended into arguments over Robert's rules or fighting over the rules. There was just it just didn't work. It just didn't work the way it was planned, the logistics, just how people registered. But my fear, Mara and Leah, is that if people take this convention this last Saturday, is what a convention is and what it has been and what it will always be, I would think that would be unfair, because I think this is truly, truly an outlier in terms of how conventions work. And I think they work by tradition a lot better than this one did. So I wouldn't put as much stock behind it that this was the funeral of our convention system. So anyway, I think it would be unfair to categorize the caucus convention cycle by what happened Saturday, but we are all well within our right to express our frustration over what that convention turned out to be.
Yeah, so Greg, I'm wondering if we could look forward a little bit, because another tweet, right, from Representative Kira Berkland talking about her daughter and a couple of friends, and she says all three kids aged 19 to 20 said it was their first time at a Republican convention and it'll be their last. So you're not wrong, right? Like, I get it. If you've been going since 1992, right, your N is much bigger, right? You know, so you have an idea of when things go well, when things don't go well. But my question is, for some people, this might have been their first one. Then how does the Republican Party do the work, if you know what I mean, to bring people back into the fold? Because maybe it shouldn't be the funeral, but maybe for people, they might be like, oh, that's it. Next year, I'm just voting in the primary.
Well, I'll say something I've been saying. I didn't plan to say on this interview, but I'll just say it. If a Democrat was the chair of the Republican Party in Utah, and the Democrats' whole goal was to destroy the caucus convention cycle, I don't know that that Democrat could do more to undermine the integrity of a GOP state convention than what we just lived through on Saturday. So, yeah, I do worry about that. I really, really do.
I'm going to take that as a suggestion, Greg.
You couldn't, Mara, you couldn't do worse. Okay, I don't care what you plan. I don't care what your evil plan would be. Yeah, wouldn't get worse than we got there.
So here's my question for you. The delegate choice was markedly different than the latest polling we're seeing. So once again, it appears, we don't know, but it appears that the delegates, 4,000 people, 4,000 delegates versus 900,000 registered Republicans who will have the option of voting in the primary, it appears as that those who the delegates choose may not be those who Republican registered voters choose. What's your perspective on that?
You oftentimes you'll see that the convention candidate is not the ultimate winner of a Republican primary in these Republican conventions. So that's not, I think, different. But I do think that once you have the signature path and you have people that are getting direct access to the primary ballot, that those that participate in caucuses and those that even campaign in caucuses, if you know you're already getting to the second round and that's not the gatekeeper to get into the primary, it changes the dynamics of your convention and even those that participate in the convention. So I do think that, and if you add to that a caucus night that many people feel was a miserable experience and then a convention that was worse, it does start to narrow down your participants in the convention caucus convention cycle, which isn't good. I think when Orrin Hatch saw that Bob Bennett lost and back then we didn't have signatures, I think we saw more people attend caucus meetings than we had voters in the Republican primary in the past, which was, I think, a positive. I think the more participation, the better, the more neighbors elect their neighbors to really get to ask the candidates hard questions. That's all upside. But the key really is more participation. And as you see moments like this weekend, it is worrisome. And if you could avoid it, although it costs a lot of money to get those signatures, if you have the money and resources to avoid it, I could see why people would want to. So I think it's going to be, you would need to have a higher participation and have a process that people had faith in. And that's going to take some building on the Republican side.
All right. Greg Hughes, former Utah Speaker of the House. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me, and good luck with Mara. Road to hoe.
Man, I'm going to need it. Thank you. Listeners, coming up after the break, we will stay with the convention and have more on what was going on there.
911, emergency.
They kidnapped my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact, he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big money on plant protection supplies now at Menards. Defend your garden with Triazicide Insect Killer. Its fast-acting formula protects lawns, vegetables, and many other plants. It kills more than 260 insects by contact, above and below ground. Choose from ready to spray, concentrate, or granular. Save big money on Triazicide Insect Killer at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Mara Carabello here with Leah Murray. And Leah, we want to introduce our next guest who has also been an elected official. She was a representative in the House, and now she is the esteemed editor of Utah Policy Daily. If you listeners are not signed up to get Utah Policy Daily's
What are you doing?
Go to utahpolicydaily.com and sign up to get Holly's newsletter. It really does cover the breadth of all things. It's a great news aggregator, but Holly also gives some interesting stats and insights on the day. And she's a daily watcher of the political process, as well as has been a Republican delegate. She's been an elected official. And Holly, we are sure glad to have you here today on KSL at Night to talk to us and give us your perspective on the convention that the Democrat or the Republicans had this last weekend.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here. Look, I'll tell you, it was, I think, the most disturbing convention I've seen, and I've been going for 22 years. So it wasn't just that there were a few delegates who had sporadic booing. It was masses of delegates who were trying to shout down the governor. There were, of course, reported incidences from the lieutenant governor saying that her young nieces were exposed to some very vile and vulgar language. There was a state legislator who had to break up an altercation that was leading towards a fist fight. I mean, it was really, really different and not super family friendly.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was struck with is I read probably a handful of social media posts talking about, I'm not going to bring my kid and I'm not going to, like, I was shocked by parents saying this isn't a place. How are we going to reconcile this sort of, particularly, frankly, the image of the Republican Party and what they stand for and the treatment that we saw people doing with each other? How do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question going forward, right? And how do you appeal to young people? How do you get young adult voters? And there was a great candidate, Zach Wilson, who is a young adult himself. He's 29. But if you looked at the makeup of the delegates, there were very few young delegates. And a lot of the even adults that I've spoken to who have young adults are like, my kids have no interest in the Republican Party and they have no interest in the caucus convention system. So the question is, how do you engage them, right? Well, you have to be able to make them feel heard, make them feel welcome. We heard multiple times that people who did not adhere 100% to a delegate's ideology, not even a candidate's, right, that they weren't welcome in the party, that they were called rhinos, that they needed to leave. I mean, it was not a friendly environment, and the for a party that's supposed to be the big tent party, it didn't feel that way on Saturday.
So Holly, as you know, I'm a college professor, and I gave students always credit. If you go to a caucus, and I always tell students, my goodness, you should learn these things, and you should go to these caucus meetings. And I want to tell you, over the years, kids write reflections, right? And so they say, I went to this caucus, and it was fun, or it was interesting. But what I think
I lost you.
Yeah. So Kara Berkland on her tweet was all three kids, age 19 to 20, said it was their first time at a Republican convention and it'll be their last. So a little bit, it's not just like they're not coming back to Republican convention, right, Holly? I worry they're not going to come back to civic engagement. You know what I mean? Like, if this is what it looks like to figure out the big questions and answering our wicked problems, you know, I'm very concerned.
Yeah, right. And that's, of course, an additional concern is if you just throw up your hands and say, well, it's just a hot mess and I'm going to walk away. I mean, I'm sure that you say this to your students as well, but it's, you know, sometimes people say, well, I'm not interested in politics. Well, politics is very interested in you, right? And it's going to impact every part of your life. And we need people to be involved. We need the people who don't feel like they're voices being heard to be involved in some way, but I don't know that the convention process is really going to be the way to do that. Those delegates skew older. They skew heavily male versus female, traditionally at least. And yet we see, you know, we're the youngest state in the nation. We don't have a lot of political engagement or involvement with our youth. And I think that's really where, if Republicans want to, quote, revitalize their party, they need to start looking for new blood.
So, Holly, something happened this convention that I have never seen, and I wanted to ask you about it. So two speeches really stood out for me, and one was Dan Hemmert, who is running for a state Senate race. He's been a state senator prior, but he's not now, and he was running for a competitive race. Two or three, Kevin Stratton notably came out to a primary with him. And the other one was Governor Cox's. And I think two things. The Hemmert speech, he stands up. Everyone else sort of gives a really traditional Republican line. He stands up and said, hey, listen, I think this system's broken. I think this is some sort of litmus test on a purity test. And I think the convention system broken. I mean, and then I'm going to move to Cox quickly. Notably, I mean, one of the best pressure speeches I have seen in a long time when he stands up and says, oh, I'm happy to join the line of people who got booed. He notably points out Orrin Hatch. He points out Governor Herbert. He then says a Relief Society president from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints got booed, and he welcomes being a part of this. And then he says, why did you boo me? Because he did X, Y, and Z, and he notes some very conservative things he did. And he closes with, or do I not hate enough? So what I was struck by is those two kind of just said to the delegates, you know what, I'm not pandering to you and I'm not playing your game. And I have not seen a mainstream candidate do that before them. Do you think that this is a crack in the veneer of mainstream Republicans not really respecting the delegate process because of the respect they're getting back?
I don't think it's the first time. I think Senator Mitt Romney has also been clear that he didn't feel the delegate process was actually one that was going to play out in the primary. And of course, he was correct, right? I remember him, you know, dressing down a candidate from the podium, saying you should be ashamed of yourself for calling him a traitor while he was trying to give a speech a few years ago. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's more and more people willing to call it out, and I'm heartened by that. I think Dan Hemmert's speech, as you pointed out, it was amazing. And Governor Cox did well under pressure. He came in knowing that he was going to be booed. He'd seen it during county conventions, and I think he was ready, even though he still had to dump his prepared speech and do this off the cuff. He did a great job.
Holly, I have a question, like just a hunch that I have that I've been thinking about. When we move to signature gathering, right? And so the answer is really, really, decisions are being made in the primaries, right? So the answer is it's not going to be decided till June. And the convention is, and I'm actually a caucus convention fan because I think it's great for conversation. And I love like getting people in a room to talk about things, not when there's this kind of vitriol, of course, but I like the idea. But I kind of wonder if what's happening is, you know, most pragmatic political people probably stayed home on Saturday because they know the answer is it's going to be in June. So I don't have to go through the process of becoming a delegate. I don't have to go spend 17 hours in these conversations. And so to what's happening is, right, that the most, you know, I'll just use the word pragmatic again, or maybe even reasonable people are just not as present as they once were. And maybe that's doing damage to this whole process.
Well, yes, I think that's probably true. Also, though, you have a system that prioritizes people with the loudest voices. So when you only have 9% of registered Republicans turning out for caucus and they struggle to get registered and to, you know, to sign up and to show up, then you have a sliver of those who become the 4,000 delegates. By the time we got to the last Senate vote, we had lost over 1,000 delegates. Almost 30% of the delegates had gone home. So it may have been that they said, you know, our guy is going to be on the ballot in the primary. I don't know for sure, but certainly it has had an impact. And I think that you will see more and more candidates who choose to completely skip the convention process and go straight to the primary.
We have been talking to the editor of Utah Policy Daily, Holly Richardson. Holly, thanks for joining KSL at Night.
My pleasure.
Wow, what a crazy convention. It'll still feel the ripple effects for it. We're going to shift gears. The FCC adopted a proposal to apply utility-like regulations to our internet service providers. We want to see what the impact will be for us, so stay tuned on KSL at Night.
911, emergency.
They kidnapped my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Did you know you can get the three things you need to know delivered right to you? Just go to KSLNewsRadio.com, click on menu, and then newsletter.
Or go to the KSL News Radio app, and you click on menu, and then it's email alerts.
This is even easier. Just text the word inbox to 57500.
Get the top national and local stories with the three things you need to know newsletter.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season two of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Mara Caraballo, and we're talking about all the interesting things. If you missed any of our shows, especially when they're me and Mara, because we have such a good time.
That's right.
We're the best. You can always go back and listen to it on KSLpodcast.com. After our show has been aired, just look up KSL at Night. Quite frankly, Mara, any app that you use to get podcasts, you're going to be able to find us being brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, you just pick out the subjects you want, watch the whole show again, listen to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, join us again.
Yeah, so here's the thing. We want to talk now about the fact that the FCC restored net neutrality. So what I want to tell you, Mara, is, I don't know, 16, 17 years ago, John Oliver did like a bit maybe on net neutrality. And for those 5 seconds, I understood exactly what we were talking about. And then poof, out of my brain and out of my hard drive went anything about this. And then it came back up and I thought, oh no, I'm going to have to learn this. Thank goodness the semester's over. I don't have to explain it to any students because I really don't know. Do you know what we're talking about? Like, what is net neutrality?
Well, I think we're lucky tonight because we have a guest that I'm going to lean on him to give us the context and the basic 101 of that. Troy Ryman is the senior practice manager for AWS Securities Risk Compliance for Strategic Accounts. Troy, thanks for joining us tonight. And I'm going to throw you that broad. Give us the 101 of what net neutrality
Cliff
is.
Notes.
Yes.
Yeah, no, great to be on. So real quick, net neutrality was something that was passed by the Federal Communications Commission. It basically assigns or controls internet service providers that we use today and basically labels them as a utility, similar to what we see as water electricity companies. It basically keeps these internet service providers from playing favorites when it comes to internet content and makes sure that their networks that they're providing us are reliable and stable. So previously, our internet service providers, they could choose to maybe reduce our internet speeds if we were using applications such as Netflix, or they could prioritize other applications or networks out there if they had pre-negotiated rates with some of these companies. However, this new ruling basically makes it so our internet service providers can no longer limit the bandwidth we paid for initially. It also makes sure that their services are robust. They, they have to make sure that they're protecting them against cybersecurity attacks, denial of service, and ransomware. So it really puts responsibility on them to make sure their infrastructures are responsible and reliable, as well as giving us what we paid for initially.
All right. So can we, this is a political show, Troy. So let me just real quick be political on this. So when it was the Obama administration, we get net neutrality. Then it's the Trump presidency and the rules change. And now it's like, I guess, deep into the Biden administration, but it feels like, is this going to be one of those things where every time we have a Democrat, we're going to get net neutrality, and every time we have a Republican, we're going to not have it? Like, is it that? Or is the FCC seeing something, does that make sense, that's causing this movement?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think we'll probably will in some case. So what we're seeing is, you know, originally when Obama was in, they saw this as an opportunity to put in some government oversight into saying, hey, our communication infrastructure is critical. We need to make sure that we put in some regulations to protect it. You know, Republicans get in under Trump and they see this as, hey, this is just the FCC, you know, reaching in and making sure that they put in additional regulations that will further strengthen their grip on our communication strategy. They're seeing this as government overreach. And they argue that, hey, by putting these stipulations on our internet service providers, it's going to chill innovation and investment in the broadband industry and make things less competitive overall.
I think
we'll continue to see this.
How does this interact with another policy segment of internet connections, which is the digital divide? This notion that these internet service providers and networks, large networks, aren't moving into less economically viable areas, often rural areas. Is there a relationship from a policy point of view between net neutrality and bridging digital divides?
Yeah, and I think we see this oftentimes, we saw this back in 2020. So right now, you look at your internet service provider as any other company, right? They're out there to make money, to bring in customers, and they're obviously going to service areas where there's a lot more customers that they can bring in. With this net neutrality law, they're looking at internet services more as, hey, we used to use this for a convenience feature and entertainment. Now they're looking at it as a critical piece of infrastructure. When COVID happened in 2020, people started to transition. A lot of their day-to-day work was done over the internet on their computers. And as a result, they looked at this as, hey, I need this to help support my family. I'm good at getting critical services. Like consulting doctors and whatnot over the internet, and they really need this service. And so now, with this new law, it makes it so that these individuals who may not have gotten as much of a network or as much of prioritization are now going to see a little bit more support out there in these rural areas.
So that just makes me wonder, Troy, are we moving in the direction of it being more like a public utility? Does that make sense? Like, is it more like I only can get Rocky Mountain Power? Is it going to look like that? Maybe short-term or long-term. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's some of the fear, right? Because what this does is it puts them in the same category as a utility. It allows the FCC to step in if it says, hey, we think your internet service provider is charging too much, or we think that when there's an outage, you know, they're not putting enough services and times in it. I mean, there's both sides of the coin, right? It helps consumers in some cases where it can help control costs. It can help make sure that our internet services are coming up and are going back down. But at the same time, if you look at it, it makes things a little less competitive if they're regulating internet prices, so no one else has to be competitive. And at the same time, it may stifle innovation where people may not want to continue to expand some of these networks and make them better if there's no return on investment.
Are there any other disadvantages that you see for regulating the internet like a public utility? Are those the primaries?
Well, I think if you see it as you do with anything else that gets regulated, I think we're seeing this in a lot of other industries such as pharmaceuticals or wherever else. When you start regulating and you start putting a lot of stipulations, it gets really hard to work in this area and incentivize other business owners from getting in. It's typically when we see other business owners from getting in and building out these services where we really start to see a competitive advantage and companies starting to get better and better services at cheaper and cheaper prices. But when we start regulating it, you know, there's just no incentive for anyone else to jump in the game. They see this too difficult, too hard, too challenging. Why would I go in there for a little bit of a return on investment? You know, and then at that point, it's just left up to the big players to play, you know, this game of offering internet services.
So let me ask you a question. It feels like if there's regulation, that means prices should go up, right? I think that's kind of when we think about, you know, how business works, that's how that goes. And then we kind of would expect that those costs would then be transferred to the consumer, right? So if it is harder for Xfinity to do all the things it's doing due to regulations, I might have to pay more. But my question, so that might be true, but Troy, I feel like during the Trump administration, when there was no net neutrality, it wasn't like our prices went down, right? So it wasn't like we went from Obama era and then all of a sudden, right? So can you kind of talk to us about, do you all expect those costs to be transferred out to consumers? If they were, then why weren't they when the net neutrality was gone? Do you know what I mean? Earlier, like just kind of talk to me about that, you know, price relationship, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people didn't see a change, or every day-to-day people see a change when net neutrality was, you know, put in place, and then when it was dissolved, and now it's going to be put back in place again. You know, what it does mean is our internet service providers, there are staples where they have to make sure that these services are reliable. They have to make sure that they're providing the services we did pay for initially. But I think internet service providers, a lot of them are probably doing this anyways. No one's going to be paying for a service that continuously goes down or is interruption. They're not going to be paying for a service that they see as slow. Today, we still have other options. And so I think a lot of what these, you know, regulations are going to oversee probably aren't going to impact too many of the service providers we're seeing today. What it is going to require them to do is probably give additional filings, reports, audit statuses, and things like that to the FTC regulators to show, yeah, we're abiding by your laws and, you know, and whatever else you had us do under this law. But that may translate into higher prices for consumers, or it may not. It just depends on how much more of an overlift it is. But, you know, that being said, we've put this in place once. There wasn't too much of a change. I wouldn't expect too much of a change of again once we put it back in.
All right. Troy Reidman, Senior Practice Manager for AWS Security. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. So today, breaking just today, Democratic candidate for Governor Brian King selected his lieutenant governor. We're going to have a conversation with her coming up next on KSL News Radio.
911, what's your emergency?
A kid, my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Jeff Kaplan from KSL News Radio. You want to receive the latest news, traffic, and weather all in one place? All you have to do is subscribe to the KSL text line. Text the word NEWS to 57500 and you'll get the latest news, traffic, and weather updates. Sometimes before we get them on the air. I'll catch you on the radio weekday afternoons on KSL News Radio.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Mara Carabello here with Leah Murray. And Leah, if you want to stay fully engaged, make sure that you have tracked the KSL text alert that can give you breaking news. So what you do is you just text the word breaking to 57500. Text the word breaking and you will be as updated as anyone else. And Leah, we get to have the very first interview. So we're, I mean,
so we're breaking something.
We're breaking something. We get to have the first interview. The Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Brian King, announced today who will be his lieutenant governor pick for the Democratic ticket. Now, remember, Brian came out of convention, a strong show of support. He will be the Democratic candidate that we'll choose from in the November election. And today he has chosen Rebecca Cummings to be his lieutenant governor running mate.
Yeah, and no, it's interesting, right?
And it's so interesting. And we're just going to maybe get right to her because we are the very first news outlet that will speak to her. So, Rebecca, congratulations and thanks for joining KSL at Night.
All right. Thank you so much, Mara and Leah. And thank you for having me. I'm excited to give my first interview.
So, Rebecca, I am wondering how you were chosen. Does that make sense? Like, why? What is it about you that makes you the right choice? How did that process work?
Sure. And that was my first question for Brian, too. Why me? I mean, first of all, I should say I am so honored and humbled to be selected as Brian's running mate. I think Brian is absolutely terrific. I've actually been a constituent of his for the past 11 years, and I've always been really impressed and felt well represented by, you know, the way that he brings real issues to the table, the way he works across the aisle. And I just know he's going to be a terrific governor for the state of Utah. I think that Brian picked me in part because I've experienced personally how Utah politics have become more extreme and polarized. As a librarian, I've been fighting book banning and censorship bills in the Utah legislature that target librarians and teachers. I mean, a few years ago, I never would have dreamed that our legislature would spend their time trying to criminalize librarians or spend time pulling more and more books from school libraries. So I think Brian picked me because we agree that Utahns are looking for a different kind of representation, that they're tired of culture wars, they're tired of extremism, and they want to see a ticket that really brings common sense solutions to real problems.
So what kind of strategies has the King campaign been talking about to, as you say, broaden those who will consider voting for a Democrat in Utah? What kind of strategies are you going to use in the next few months to entice people over to the King's coming ticket?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's obviously a Republican state, but I think we're really hoping to take advantage of the fact that a lot of people are at an inflection point right now. I think a lot of people feel politically homeless. You know, they maybe grew up thinking that they were Republicans, but feel kind of disenchanted with the state of government and feeling like they're not really represented or that their representatives aren't spending time on things that they care about. Brian and I are coming into this with issues that I think resonate with a lot of Utahns, making sure that we get water to the Great Salt Lake, making sure that we're cleaning the air, making sure that our public schools are adequately funded, and making sure also that we're protecting people's individual freedoms, you know, giving them, you know, trusting that they can make the best choices for their own reproductive health or what books that they want to read, for example. And I think that our message really does resonate with a lot of people.
Yeah. And so I noticed, or didn't notice, you've been saying it, but I read it in the thing before we started having the conversation, that your big platform point is that you are against book banning. As a librarian, I'm a fellow educator, professor up at Weber State. Oh. I am very concerned thinking about academic censorship, right? And I'm kind of wondering, like, your point is well taken, but this is a Republican state, and I'm not sure, I'm not sure that I'm persuaded legislators came up with these ideas in the night, right? So there must be people in the state of Utah who have concerns about books, who have concerns about curriculum I might be teaching. I'm wondering how, does that make sense? Like, how you combat this? What is the way that your campaign looks to go after this, not just about, hey, Republicans are doing this, but there may be voters who have genuine concerns. Like, how do you address those?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, that's a great question. And of course, there are people who are concerned about things like, you know, books, for example, that they're concerned that there might be books that contain some sexual content in their school libraries. But that really does represent a minority of people. We've done a ton of polling on this. First of all, we can see that the people who are submitting these book challenges are an extreme minority. In Davis County, for example, it was a single couple that filed 199 out of the 204 book challenges in their system. And I think this is true nationwide, that we have a vocal minority driving the conversation and getting in the ear of legislators. But I think many, many more people care about things like making sure that we have clean air, clean water, great schools, support for things like public libraries and public parks. And they're far less worried about culture war issues like CRT or book banning, for example. But you are right. It was the book banning fight that brought me to the table in politics. I never would have dreamed that I'd be as involved as I am. But I started to become really concerned about this back in 2018, when it first started, where we were getting these challenges to database and books. And libraries have always welcomed challenges, but they were coming by the hundreds and by people who obviously hadn't read the books, you know, in their entirety, if at all. And you know, I think that that just is a really great example of some of the extremism and the outrage that's been driving our politics. And the hope for Brian and I is that we can convince people that when we have, you know, single party control in Utah, it leads to this kind of extremism. And a ticket with me and Brian would be a little bit of a check on a legislature and maybe bring things back to common sense solutions and good government.
So one of the things we've been hearing a lot this whole election cycle starting a year ago is this divide between rural Utah and urban Utah. Mm-hmm. What do Democrats offer rural Utah?
That is a great question. But first of all, I do want to say I'm really eager to hear directly from rural Utahns and hear what their concerns are, because I know I still have more to learn in this area. But I think that just in general, what Democrats have to offer rural Utahns is making sure there are things like living wages that keep up with the cost of housing and the cost of living, you know, making sure that more people have health care, making sure we have equity in educational access. I mean, as much as we make a distinction between the urban-rural divide, and of course there are some real distinctions, I think all of us want the same thing, and that is to be able to work hard, live with dignity, have health care, raise our kids, know that there's affordable housing, and I think this is where Democrats have a lot to offer rural Utah.
Your bio, Rebecca, says that you believe in pragmatic governance. Like, can you talk to me, what is that? What do you mean when you say that? What does that look like?
That's a great question. Let's unpack it. I think pragmatic governance is really thinking more about how we can help people and making good decisions over worrying about ideological purity. You know, if we expect someone to be perfect and agree with us 100% of the time, we're not going to have a lot of allies. One of my favorite quotes was actually from Ronald Reagan, where he said, if you agree with me 80% of the time, you're an 80% ally, not a 20% traitor. And I love that, because I think it's okay that we have some disagreement, for example, even within the Democratic Party, but that we're listening to people in good faith, we're talking to lots of different people to hear what they care about, and we're passing laws that actually make their lives better.
Well said. Rebecca Cummings, who is the running mate, the lieutenant governor, on the ticket with Brian King for the Democratic gubernatorial ticket. I'm sure this was the first we've heard from you. I know this won't be the last. Good luck with your election, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I mean, the polling shows that Utah Democrats, it's an important disclaimer in front of it, Utah Democrats are very much in alignment with traditional values, but they've had a hard time breaking through party labels. Mm-hmm. So it'll be really interesting. Brian King, a very seasoned member of the House of Representatives, has given up his seat, moved to this. And we heard for the first time Rebecca Cummings, who will be his running mate. It'll be interesting to watch how they move along during this legislative session. Next on KSL, a deal was signed by Colorado River Commission that gives tribes the right to the lease. This is several states and several tribes and the Colorado River, which we depend on for water. So stay tuned on KSL at night. We'll talk more about it.
911, what's your emergency?
They kidnapped my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Mara Carabello. And Mara, I feel like you have feelings about water.
I have feelings. I love water. I love all things water. Now, we're about to talk to a real water engineer who will, you know, perhaps take a shot at my water chops. But yeah, water. So a Western state, you know, what's that adage? Whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. I mean,
I've never heard that before, but I'm going to like hashtag that somewhere on my life.
We live and die by it. And we have had a couple of we've had a couple decades, but it's really caught up in the public's imagination and the forethought of publics, our drought. In the last couple of years only, that showed up in our lakes and in our rivers. And a lot of us really map to Lake Powell for recreation, but also for water. And that means also the Colorado River. And we're lucky tonight to have Gene Shawcroft, who is the Colorado River Commissioner for Utah. So this is the representative that goes and negotiates with the six other seven total states who share the Colorado River for very much their drinking water and all things. And we're one of these states. Gene is our representative to that. And we wanted to talk to him today about a couple of things. So, Gene Shawcroft, thanks for joining us on KSL at Night.
Happy to join you, ladies.
Oh, I just had a question before, because Mara knows so much more about this than I do, Gene, so just suffer with me. But maybe listeners are like me, too, and don't know as much. Can you tell us the state of play at the moment? So is it the case that the states are still in charge? Is it the case that the federal government has told us we don't know what we're doing, is kind of moved in, or is that happening later? So can you give us like context real quick for this conversation?
Absolutely. Happy to do so. I think most people are aware that there are some guidelines that dictate how the river will be used over the next several years. Those guidelines expire in 2025, and we're working on new guidelines to identify how the water will be used beyond 2025. The upper division states, so that's Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Wyoming, have a joint proposal that we submitted to the Secretary's office through the Bureau of Reclamation about a month ago. The lower division states had an alternative that they submitted as well. Those alternatives have some similarities. They have some differences. Reclamation is analyzing those at this moment in time and look forward to the seven of us getting back together, which we are doing. There's still time for us to prepare a seventh state alternative, which, of course, would please the Bureau of Reclamation if we could come to that point.
So the lower division states are Arizona, California, and Nevada, some big hitters there. And they have been really on top of organizing their advocacy, I'm going to say, for years and years. The smaller states in Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, of which we're a part of, Gene, as you said, the Upper River, we've been smaller about it. One of the things I'm struck by, but I was hoping you could... We talk about this agreement, and we've seen a lot of news talking about is it, and Leah's great question about, is it holding together? Is it falling apart? What you have a front row seat. This agreement has been in place since 1920, and you guys are really doing the hard work. There is no easy work left. So it's, I know, hard, but you all have found a way to continue to talk until you compromise. What's the tone when you sit at those meetings with other state representatives?
It's very cordial. There are ideas that are a little bit different, of course, and we try to focus on what those differences are. At the end of the day, each of those seven representatives have to go back to their home state and sell to the constituency of their individual state what we have agreed to in terms. And so not only is it a discussion around that relatively small table, but it's also a discussion around many tables as each of us go back to our individual states.
So you had a huge agreement last, or an agreement that was signed last week I wanted you to just mention. There are a couple of other players at the table. Mexico's at the table, but also many tribes are at the table. What happened last week with the conversations with, correct me if I'm wrong, I think 6 tribes?
That is correct. So I'm happy to note that last Monday, as you mentioned, a week ago today, in Chama, New Mexico, and after nearly 2 years of working closely together, the upper division states that we've mentioned through the Upper Colorado River Commission, which is, again, those 4 upper division states, signed a memorandum of understanding with the 6 Native American tribes in the Upper Colorado River Basin. And just briefly, the MOU reflects the commitment on the part of the upper basin tribes and states to work collectively and collaboratively as decisions are made that impact water on the Colorado River. And if you'd like, I can give you just a few details about the MOU. But for the most part, the bigger part, it's an effort to solidify our agreement or our thoughts that we're better off sharing information, collaborating together on items of mutual interest in the river. And that's really what it's all about. There are some near-term and long-term priorities. However, I want to make very clear that this MOU does not address in any fashion the sovereign-to-sovereign relationships that exist between the individual tribes and the individual upper division states and the United States.
So talk to me about, so when it's just the upper states, so that makes it the 4 that are not Nevada, Arizona, and California. And I appreciate totally what you're saying, right? So it's an MOU so that you all are sharing information. But are you not sharing information with the lower river states and tribes? Does that make sense? And then how does that inform conversations about usage going forward?
Sure. The way the water is used, each state includes in its allocation the amount of water that is delivered or will be delivered to the tribes. And so the tribes in the upper basin that work with the upper basin states, of course, are the ones that we are most concerned about, because the lower division states have to deal with and coordinate with their tribes in their individual states because their tribal allotments are included within the state allotments.
So, okay, I want to shift a little to hydrology. I think the other day you and I were talking, Gene, and I was celebrating what was apparently another successful water season in Utah. And I was talking about Colorado River and Lake Powell. And you dropped an engineering bombshell on me in which you said, hey, listen, Mara, don't really think about Utah's water as much when it comes to Utah's share of the Colorado River. Think about like the western slope of Colorado, and that's where the feeder is. So talk just high level with us about feeding into Colorado River. And really what I want to know is, how is Lake Powell doing? How will we found boaters? What's the boating season for Lake Powell looking like?
Great. The important things of life.
That is right.
Certainly, the snowpack in Utah was about 120% of normal, which is awesome. It would have been really awesome, but for last year, which really made us understand what we could really get, but about 120% of normal in Utah. Western Colorado was just about normal, and that's where the majority of the water comes from the west slope of Colorado. Wyoming was about normal as well. So the overall projected runoff into Lake Powell this year is about 87%, about 8.4 million acre feet. Lake Powell today is about 32% full. There's 140 feet of air between the water and the high water mark in the reservoir, which of course would be wonderful to fill. That will not happen in any kind of a short term. However, we're about 35 feet higher today in Lake Powell than we were a year ago. And with the epic water we had last year, Lake Powell came up about 65 feet, which is absolutely wonderful. And the lake is starting to fill now with the runoff. In the last 2 weeks, it's come up about a foot, and it will continue to come off as runoff until about early July. That's generally when the peak of the runoff is tapering off, and the outflow gets to be about equal to the inflow. And so that's about where we are on Lake Powell, generally 35 feet higher than we were last year. Yet we still have a long way to go to fill the reservoir.
Oh, there you go. Gene, I could talk about water forever, but we have to wrap it tonight. Gene Shawcroft, Colorado River Commissioner for Utah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you both.
So next up on KSL at Night, we'll move away from water and into transportation, another issue of interest in Utah, especially in Salt Lake City. You'll want to hear what our guest has to say. Stay with us.
911, emergency.
Kidnap my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Mara Carabello here with Leah Murray. And Leah, our state, we have heard this more and more. Our state's a growing state. We're going to double our population. All of that gets told to us all the time. Now, whether you are a Salt Lake City resident or not, growth means traffic, and most of us at one time or another are going to hit downtown Salt Lake, whether that is for shopping, whether that is to visit Temple Square. And now we have a basketball arena that's going to get a hockey arena, and there's talk of a major league stadium. So we wanted to take a minute to talk about transportation and transportation planning, specifically in Salt Lake City, because, again, whether you live here permanently or not, with the congestion, with us growing and growing, boy, transportation's a big old challenge.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you what, before we get into this, because I don't live in Salt Lake City.
Right.
But Friday night, they shut down 89 on Friday.
I
feel like, just for the fun of it, I'm sure it was a good reason. But
yeah.
Man.
Water.
Yeah, like the
water
entire.
Was the reason.
Yeah, water. That's right. It was water. But the entire southern Weber County was a parking lot, Mara. Like, you couldn't move, right? And so people were posting on social media like, it is, you know, zombie apocalypse out here. We can't move. So being thoughtful as you have growth, when you need to do projects like water, about alternate routes of travel. Does that make sense? And being
right.
able to do that, right? Smart people do better planning to make sure those kind of things, like that you can handle a water project without causing the whole place to shut down.
And Westerners, we are so car-centric, so car-dependent, and so intolerant of any traffic problems. So to sort through where Salt Lake City specifically is going, we have Joe Taylor, the transportation planner for the Salt Lake Transportation Division. And Joe, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So, okay, we're going to talk about some history for a second. The last major transportation plan for Salt Lake City was in 1996, about 30 years ago. So much has changed. What of the plan are you still using? What are the plans to get a new forward-looking transportation planning system?
Yeah, so the 1996 plan is actually a remarkably, really still great document. And it, you know, has a lot in it that we're still focused on. It promotes transit really heavily, which I think in the last 30 years in Salt Lake City has come a long way. One kind of major move that we made in updating this new plan is that we really put it to our residents about what they valued in our roadway system. We wanted to focus on promoting those values in all of our transportation projects. And so by focusing on values, you know, we're not necessarily promoting any single one way of getting around. We know a lot of people still want to drive, and that's how they're going to choose to get around. But We want to make sure that things are first and foremost safe, but also that, you know, people feel like they can get places reliably, and also that, you know, sort of the network of transportation is, I guess, not just for moving things around, but also ensuring that our downtown specifically, but the city more broadly, is just also a really great place to be. And so there may be space in the roadway, you know, that's not for moving vehicles or people around, but for creating great sort of places that you want to spend time.
All right. So you said you asked people about their values. Can you give us like a specific example, like what popped in those conversations that was something that Salt Lake City residents are valuing that you all are trying to address with this new plan?
Yes, yeah, so safety really rose to the top there. That's something that people just said that they wanted to, you know, feel safe, whether they're in a vehicle or walking around or on their bicycle. Affordability was a big concern for our residents. You know, I think affordability is kind of present in everybody's mind in every aspect of their life. But whether they're taking the bus or maintaining and driving a car, you know, those costs, they wanted to make sure it was something that they could you know, afford to get around and live in Salt Lake City. They wanted to make sure that, you know, everybody in Salt Lake City, whether they owned a car or two cars or were dependent on a bus pass, had a set of choices that would work for them. So, you know, they really wanted to make sure that there were equitable choices. And then, sorry, I'm just pulling the last one because I don't want to miss anything. Also, you know, just that the sustainability aspect of transportation was being looked at. You know, vehicles contribute to poor air quality. That's an area that we can really address. So sustainability was the other big value.
So, Joe, what kind of policies have you put into place recently that keep up with new technologies, whether that is synchronizing lights and traffic flow, which I know has seen a lot of technological advances, or, as you suggest, sustainability materials being used, using porous soils and different kinds of concretes? What is Salt Lake City doing in the last 5 or so years to keep up with the technology?
Yeah, there's a lot, and technology is something that I think, you know, wasn't really considered in the old plan that has really just presented both a lot of challenges and opportunities in the transportation sector. So you mentioned signal timing. You know, our emergency services use that, and we're starting to use it more with our transit vehicles. And then, you know, porous pavements. We haven't built a whole lot of new roads in Salt Lake City, but as we begin to expand, you know, into the western part of the city, that's definitely something we're going to consider. And then there's also, you know, just sort of this whole realm of kind of app-based transportation. You know, you can hail a ride with your phone, you can get a scooter. So just making sure that, you know, our, especially downtown, our really precious curb space is available at the highest and best use to all of those kind of new technologies that people are using to get around, maybe without their personal vehicle. And then, you know, the plan doesn't really get into it, but I think that a challenge we're going to be looking at in at least the near future, if not the medium term, is just that there's going to start to be more drone transportation, whether that's delivery services or maybe even getting into the realm of personal transportation.
So, Joe, in there you talked about something about the west side of the city. And I feel like one of the things we talk about a lot is this kind of east-west Salt Lake City divide. Sometimes when you have conversations with people, like, they're referencing, you know, the west side not getting that much love, or when they're looking at things. Can you talk to us about whether your plan, these new plans, address that bifurcation, if you will, of the city?
Yeah. So as we talk to people, and we talk to thousands of people, either in person or via survey, the east-west divide, you know, became very apparent that that was the single biggest transportation problem on people's minds. And that problem is not just one of getting from east to west. It's not just a mobility problem, but that it's perceived as kind of a psychological divide, and that it's driven the way that, you know, investment patterns have happened. And we're talking about, you know, a divide that even really predates the incorporation of the city itself. So we don't have, you know, a clear this is what we're going to do to face this challenge. But there are a series of, you know, sort of big ideas in the plan, looking at just, you know, either going over or under or around the freeway and the rail line in a way that makes sense for folks, you know, both that live on the west side and have to deal with it every day, and also just you know, everybody in the city. And I'll add to that, we're just about to undertake a 2-year study that's a federally funded study to really dig into that more deeply. And by dig into it, I mean really get down with the people who live it every day and not just propose technical solutions, but really understand from the community what their specific challenges are and also what, you know, solutions would work for them.
So, Joe, we only have about 20 seconds, but is transportation, from your point of view, if you build it, they will come? So I feel like that's been on the approach with bikes. Or do you just build out to what we're doing? Which approach do you take?
You know, I think what we're really starting to do is not necessarily do what's been working, although there is a lot that has been working for a long time, but really just trying to make sure that we are espousing these values we heard and building towards what will promote them. So we don't want to take a choice away from anybody. You know, we don't necessarily have a dog in any fight. We want you to get around in a way that you feel safe and comfortable. But we want to make sure that we're providing options so that when people do want to make a different choice, or they do want to, you know, transform in a roadway into something more than just a place for people to get around, they have the option to do that.
Joe Taylor, transportation planner for Salt Lake City, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So retiring, you know, Leah, someday.
Not yet.
Someday we're going to do it. Well, after the break, we're going to take a look into the growing trend of people retiring early. So if you want to know how or why they're doing it, stay tuned with us on KSL at Night.
911, emergency.
They kidnapped my son.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, "Your dad has been hurt really bad."
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside Mara Carabello. And we've had an excellent 2 hours, Mara.
So fun.
And here's the deal. We enjoyed our conversation and we might listen to it again. And if you want to listen to it again, you should find our podcast on KSLpodcast.com. After the show's been aired, just look up KSL at Night. Right, Mara? And they can pick, like, they only want to hear Mara episodes. They can only hear Mara episodes, I think, right?
Well, you know, you can choose Mara and Leah. You can choose a topic that you heard the tail end of, didn't get to see the first part. So go to our podcast and listen to the whole segment.
Yeah. So, Mara, during people's lives, there are big events, right? Yeah. And we're always saving money for it. And you and I have talked a lot because both of us have kids going to college.
Right.
Right. So college is something you save a lot of money for. And I feel like that's the phase of my life I'm in, is saving money for my kids to go to college. Except this weekend, sitting next to a 17-year-old who was graduating with her associate's degree at the same time as
what?
High school, she says to me, "Oh, so do you have a pension?" To which I was like, "Do I look old enough to have a pension?" And oh my gosh, now we're in a fight here on the stage at the graduation. But she was thinking, I guess very smartly, very far forward thinking as a 17-year-old about what you do when you retire, right?
Yeah.
Like maybe what she thought was, you look young and hip and maybe you'll be an early retirer. I don't think so. I think she thought I was super old, Mara. But basically she was talking about the other big thing that you would be doing with money, which is saving for retirement.
Although she seems to be the exception to the rule, because 20% of Americans over the age of 50 have no money saved for retirement at all.
Dude, when I was reading that, that just sounded crazy to me. The other thing I thought was interesting in this data was 70% of retirees stopped working before 65. So a lot of people feel like that's the age I'm going to retire is 65. 70% actually stopped before 65. 46% because of other things, right? So they weren't planning it, they weren't expecting it. 35% saying due to a hardship, like a health issue or a disability. And then you got to kind of go, can they even afford it, right? So if you haven't planned, if you're one of the 20% who have no money saved at all, you haven't planned and now you're retiring early, how are you going to live those, you know, extra?
All these questions. Boy, they're so stress invoking. Yeah. So to help bring down our stress level, we have Kristen Cooper, who is the president of Axios Capital, with us here tonight. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So, okay, let's talk about how much people need to retire first. Give us some high water marks or averages in which we would be, regardless maybe of our age. I guess not, because we've got a plan for how much longer we'll be alive. So how much does the average person need?
Well, I always say that I understand people want a finite number. And I just really hate those type of studies and giving out an actual number, because it's really about, well, how tax efficient mm-hmm. are you? How much do you have saved, right? Lots of people have tax-free streams of income set up, or do they have good risk management plan? And if you do, right, then they probably don't need as much money as they think.
Yeah, I love that answer.
Right. Yeah. And well, on the other hand, what if they don't? What if they don't have a good tax plan in place? Right. They have to lean on qualified plans and they just don't know. They have poor risk management strategy.
So, Kristen, right there, when you say risk management, do you mean like people who are retiring wanting to go bungee jumping? And so that might cause a problem? Or like, what do you mean by risk management when you say that?
So when I say risk management, I'm talking about sequence of return risk, the upward and downward movement of the market.
Gotcha.
Like, I mean, I've had lots of people call in or talk to me about that. Like, oh, well, I have 30 years in retirement. I can wait till it bounces back. Well, do you really to do the things you want to do in retirement? Right? What does your picture look like? So I kind of backdoor the number based on these questions. What do I want to do in retirement? What kinds of things do I actually want to do? What if we have a clear picture of that, then we can quantify a number. But if you truly want a number, I'll say, you know, $1 million was what my grandfather had. That was his goal. I need $1 million. My dad, it wasn't that number, right? And nowadays, the way inflation is, I double that number.
Wow. So when you say $1 million.
Yeah, my stomach hurts now, Chris.
Do you mean dollars? is it paper dollars? Is it house equity? Is it everything? Like,
oh, that's every asset you could think of. Okay. Every asset you could think of. Yeah, okay. No. So don't think, okay, I have to have $1 million in my 401k.
Suitcases in my mattress isn't where we're
yes,
headed.
Yes, yes. Every little asset, right, is okay. What I picture, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So talk to those of us who are above 50. Let's say we've done zero preparation. Where's the first, like, I feel like biting it all off is intimidating. Where would I start? Sure. What would be the first practice I would put into place if I'm older and don't feel prepared?
Maxing out your Roth 401k. That's the first advice I give.
Wow, she knew the answer immediately, didn't she? She didn't even think about it. I love that, Kristen.
That's my first thing when people come in. I see that they have a traditional 401k. And I said, well, the laws changed last year. Most companies are implementing a Roth 401k. Why aren't you maxing that out? I mean, you might have to pay some taxes now, but they're low now, right? Yeah. With how much national debt we have, it's going up.
So, Kristen, I was reading one of the tips, was not what you just said, but one of the tips is to prioritize retirement over college, right? And so, you might have heard the top of the segment, I'm sending two kids to college in the next 5 years. Mara's got kids in college, right? So a little bit in my head, I'm like, oh, no, right now I got to figure out getting these kids to college. Can you talk us through what that looks like to prioritize retirement over college?
Okay. Well, you absolutely have to prioritize your retirement over college. There's so many optimal ways to finance college versus if you can't finance retirement. If you have lack of savings and retirement assets, there's no wiggle room there. Retirement has to come first, the end. If I can just give you an example, can I give you an example?
Yes, please. Of course.
Okay, I know that's kind of harsh, right?
No, but I love it.
Very harsh. Yeah. Okay, so my oldest put her way through college. I'm a retirement planner. right? I wanted her to learn the work ethic. She worked three jobs in the summer. I would supplement here and there. She applied to every scholarship out there. Even if it didn't have her qualifications, she applied, right? So you can get financing so many different ways. But you cannot, like I said, you cannot finance retirement. And no one wants to live on Social Security alone.
That makes so much sense when you say it. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm a political consultant, and I just, there's nothing in a poll that is too granular for me. Like, you want to talk about hours of polling data, I'm totally there for you. But my attention span on finances, like, this is by way of confessional. I know it's how important it is. I know how much it should matter. I need some good resources for those of us who don't pay as much attention as we should. We know it. I'm guilt-ridden by it. But what are some good ways for me to stay current and smart on financing, retiring, investing, when it is just not my interest area?
Oh, I read a lot of books. I mean, I have a list of books on different ways. I mean, there's no right answer. You just need to educate yourself. Any book out there, there's so many out there. Stress-Free Retirement by Patrick Kelly. There's The Power of Zero by David Knight. I mean, they all talk about vehicles that you can utilize, right, to help finance your retirement. Other than you going to work and you know, your HR rep gives you your 401k paperwork, right? And then they don't tell you anything else.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm constantly telling people just being informed is powerful, right? Being uninformed is legal too, but you don't want to run around with your head cut off and not having the information.
Yeah, it makes
information
sense.
Information is power.
I love that. Kristen Cooper, you have been great. You're the president of Axios Capital, and we're so grateful you joined us tonight on KSL.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Leah, we have five tips for retirement that we've got. Save aggressively. Save.
And I feel like that's what Kristen said, right?
Yeah,
maxing out your Roth IRA.
Yeah, save. Avoid lifestyle creep. Boy, that one's true. Like, don't all of us make more than we ever thought we would when we were 16
right, so
and we can't
all
account
the
for it,
yeah.
Right? Include healthcare in your savings goals. Prioritize retirement over college. You hit that one. That was so true for me. Run the numbers. See what you can live on. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, listeners, for joining us tonight, and keep paying attention to KSL at Night.
What would you do if your child disappeared and someone you trusted was responsible?
We thought he cared for McKay, when in fact he didn't care for anyone.
Listen to Ransom now at ransompodcast.com.